Thomas speculates that the numbers might relate to the 32nd and 33rd aliens recovered by the U.S. military. The team elected to call them simply G and L. Much later, it was determined that G was male, L female. Thomas remains amazed at the aliens' ability to convey a sense of humor, or sadness, for example, without such feelings manifesting facially. As time went by, it became possible to feel their thoughts, and it was always clear what they meant. They did speak audibly on occasions, not that it helped. The problem in our inability to converse by voice was that their language contained no vowels, he explained. Thus, if they spoke to us, we would hear a series of unintelligible sounds not unlike the chattering of small animals. However, the airmen later learned from their duty officer that although official communications from G and L did not involve actual spoken words, the Americans confirmed that they do have voices, presumably capable of communicating in English and other languages. Thomas and the others liked the aliens from the outset and grew to care for them deeply over the approximately 20-month period involved. One lovely summer's day, Thomas and Alan were sitting beside the Greys, as they apparently were referred to occasionally by the military, even at that time, surveying the countryside through the large window of their enclosure. "What is worrying you both?" said the aliens. "Is this not the kind of day when you should feel all is well?" The men were indeed worried about the aliens. "Thanks to you, airmen, we are doing well and recovering," the Greys responded. "You need not worry about us." When communicating, G and L would put one hand on their chest to convey who was speaking. Then began a discourse, warning of Earth's future overpopulation, the poisoning of its environment, and so on. "We know your instructions are to inform your seniors of all we say. Do so. We will be telling them all we have told you when they pay their regular visits." Like other alien groups, they confirmed man's extraterrestrial genetic links. The majority of flora and fauna on this planet have evolved over millions of years. Humans were one of those that were genetically manipulated, and thus you are related to another species as a planned experiment by beings from another world. Our presence here is of right, and we have visited before this time, many times. Our present role is to observe others who are here, to see that they are not destructive and to give you some of our technology in order that you will survive, if you have earned the right to survival as we judge it. That was the core of our message to Earth people and part of the reason for our arrival in your time of 1947, though we reneged upon that in that July month, and here two of us remain, at least for a little longer. At this juncture, G reached out and clasped hands with L. I felt there was significance in the comment "at least for a little longer," linked with the hand clasp, writes Thomas. The two aliens had been held captive for at least 8 years. Not much of an existence for people who know how to travel light years distance, and had somehow done so to reach Earth. The Code Orange team were never present when the aliens took their meals. Although some thin tubes were present in their glass enclosure, their purpose was indeterminable. Waste matter, perhaps? Eventually, G and Dell, having picked up the men's bewilderment, communicated some details. "You have been wondering if we feed, and how we do so. We know your seniors have not told you. Knowledge is important to all life. We feed on blood and water. Yes, I can feel your reaction, but our race does not digest solids. Both liquids are available on this planet, and we partake of small amounts of each in order to survive. We also breathe your air, though it is clearer in some regions of your planet than others. Your seniors obtain enough food for our needs and provide us with it in your absence." Thomas told me he recalls that the blood, presumably from slaughtered animals, was obtained from a local farm. In an interesting letter to a magazine, written in 2001, he made some apposite references to the consumption of blood, without, of course, citing his own experience. Over the years, certain peoples have been vilified by modern attitudes against the terrors of blood sacrifices, he wrote. However, if genetically modified humans, ruled by their makers up to a time when they, our makers, leave the planet, and have had at times to entertain and consort with said makers, then they would have to provide the necessary correct food. What if there was, or is, a race of beings which have evolved to feed on blood. As simple as that. It may appall some of us, even possibly most of us, yet we are talking alien creatures here. A race apart, light years apart. Evolving on a planet or planets away from and not far from this Earth. So along comes a race of beings which lives on blood from animals rather than the meat. And when they arrive as gods or powerful beings, we in due deference feed them with what they require. 4. In this context, G and L related how their people had influenced the Inca, Aztec, and Maya cultures. For nutrition on their own planet, G and L indicated that they also consumed other liquids of varying thicknesses, from water through to heavy soups, plus a variety of what we would term wines made from fruits and vegetables growing on their own planet. Espionage. When Thomas's leave period came up, he went to his home in Barnstaple, Devon. Waiting at Taunton Station for the connecting train, he was approached by a well-dressed, well-spoken man who invited Thomas for a cup of tea. "I can always tell an airman," he said. Acknowledging the fact, Thomas explained that he was on 72-hour leave. Over tea, the man asked Thomas what he did in the RAF. He replied in vague generalities, mentioning bomber command and admin work. "Ah, so you are in the RAF but with the Fleet Air Arm crowd?" "Yes, I know all about that. An interesting posting, no doubt." Thomas gave nothing away. As the steam train for Barnstaple drew in, the stranger invited Thomas to join him in a first-class compartment. Sitting opposite this man in an empty carriage, a strong feeling of unease crept over Thomas, particularly when the stranger placed a hand on his knee. "Don't worry. Here's my card. I am an MP, Member of Parliament. My name is Tom Dryburgh." The notorious homosexual MP for Barking, Dryburgh, later Lord Bradwell, a member of the Communist Party of Great Britain and a close friend of the traitor Guy Burgess, had links with the Soviet KGB and its Czechoslovakian counterpart. Coincidentally, Dryburgh happened to be staying for the weekend at the Imperial Hotel in Barnstaple, and Thomas was invited for tea in his room at the hotel to show his paintings, which were never returned. Distinctly uncomfortable at the prospect, he nonetheless turned up and managed to resist Dryburgh's approaches, not least being his persistence in trying to gather information regarding the nature of Thomas's work. Thomas was also invited, together with his girlfriend, to attend a play at the Queen's Hall Theatre. During the evening, a local couple who were friends of Dryburgh's introduced Trevor to Dryburgh's friend Lord Robins. Alfred Robins, Baron Robins of Woldingham, a well-known industrialist, trade unionist, and Labour politician, was Shadow Foreign Secretary at that time. After the show, a drinks party was held at the couple's home, during which Dryburgh made further passes at Thomas and offered to give him a camera to record his activities at the camp. Thomas retorted that cameras were forbidden. Back at Weston's Oiland, G and L expressed complete knowledge of, and disquiet at, the weekend's developments, though they were well aware that Thomas had betrayed nothing sensitive. Further education. Sometimes days went by with nothing said by G and L. But over the months, a great deal of fascinating information was imparted to the team, described by Thomas in great detail in his book. The aliens communicated that they had visited Earth over a long period. As a naturalist, the airman was delighted to learn a great deal about, for example, mythical sea creatures on Earth millennia ago. The aliens, having visited Earth many times over many centuries, knew at first hand about evolution and extinctions, and spoke of other aliens who had visited Earth, carrying out their experiments. It helped that G and L saw colors as we did, and though their eyes were considerably larger, they seemed to have eyesight and other senses akin to our own. While careful not to reveal the location of their home planet, which had three moons and was in a solar system with five other planets of similar size, the aliens were forthcoming regarding a description of same, describing their planet in great detail, to which Thomas devotes considerable space in his book, describing numerous types of creatures, some very similar to our own. The aliens reiterated that the overpopulation of Earth, combined with pollution, would lead to catastrophic consequences during the 21st century. Everything they had observed on this planet in previous millennia was recorded on crystals and retained on the mother craft, which transported them and their smaller craft. They could have shown us much on their screens in the craft still held in the camp, said Thomas, but they did not completely trust our seniors, hence the craft remaining closed. Reasons for Roswell. G and L discussed the so-called Roswell incident, which, as we learned earlier, was said to have involved three craft. The remains of the damaged craft will continue to be examined, as will medical analysis of our people. Both have been examined so intensely since your year of 1947 that it is surely time our people were laid to rest and not be moved constantly from liquid solutions and frozen state to be further examined by your scientists and, we fear, at least one alien race your people consort with. Following the ends of World Wars I and II, the aliens contacted our leaders, in 1919 and 1946 respectively, to openly offer their assistance, and to be seen to do so, but were rebuffed. So they informed the American and British military and governments of their intention to offer scientific instruments to forward human progress rapidly and without cost. Thus did the Roswell event occur, with its subsequent spreading of falsehoods. The Code Orange team were informed that the reason the aliens visited New Mexico owed largely to the sighting of American military bases there, including one site that received and transmitted messages from beings other than themselves. They also said that New Mexico and a neighboring state had alien bases built into mountainsides beneath the ground, such as the Manzano Mountains, I learned from another source, and the detaining and throwing of American military and government personnel, the latter including numerous scientists, I have been told, had occurred up to the time G and L had been transported to Britain at their own insistence. Our own activities required monitoring by other than human beings, Thomas explained, simply because Earth is a vital and necessary planet for others. We could not be permitted to despoil it, even though despoliation had begun and we were doubted as to our integrity and genuine concern for the planet and its myriad life forms. G said, much to our disappointment, that humans could be seen as a malign race, and we were partial aliens in any case. Cattle mutilations. G indicated that a number of beings of a certain race had been collecting samples of our animals and plants. This was mainly in the USA, the then current project involving cattle, which they did not possess, but intended to. They said the powers that be know about it, Thomas explains, and compensation was paid to cattle owners who reported losses. It needs to be pointed out here that in this time period, 1955-57, the cattle mutilation phenomenon was unknown to the general public. It was not until several decades later that researchers became aware of it. As Colonel Philip J. Gosso reveals in his book The Day After Roswell, in 1997 this may sound like a nightmare out of a flying saucer horror movie, but in 1957 this was our thinking both in the White House, National Security Council staff, of which Gosso was a member, and in the military. We didn't know, but we had irrefutable evidence that ABEs, extraterrestrial biological entities, were landing on farms, harvesting vital organs from livestock, and then just leaving the carcasses on the ground because they knew we couldn't do anything about it. The mutilations that interested the national security personnel seemed to have the same kind of modus operandi. Whoever went after the animals seemed most interested in the mammary, digestive, and reproductive organs, especially the uteruses from cows. In many cases the eyes or throats were removed in a type of surgery in which the demarcation line was almost microscopically thin and the surrounding tissue showed that the incision had superheated and then blackened as it cooled. But the crime scene and forensic specialists noted that in any type of cut by a predatory animal or a human, even a skilled surgeon, one would find evidence of some trauma in the surrounding tissue. But forensic examination showed no evidence of collateral trauma or even inflammation, implying the cuts to extract the tissue were made so quickly and wounds were sealed so fast that the surrounding tissue was never destroyed. 5. We asked, would it not have been simpler to have had a farm on which all the necessary animals, and presumably plants too, could have been part of a humane project to avoid hurting cattle and such, Thomas writes, "We were told Hurt did not come into it. The aliens used what we now know as a form of laser, which immediately kills the target. At least, they said, it was so in this instance, but the extremely intense beam was mainly used for surgical operations to heal." Kosso provides confirmation that what turned out to be a laser device was found by the Army in the Roswell spacecraft and would later develop as a weapon in cooperation with Hughes Aircraft. As head of the Army's Foreign Technology Division, Kosso himself assembled the information to support laser product development with military funds before the whole operation was turned over to one of the research and development specialists. 6. The Path to Doom. 400 Earth years was the average lifespan for these aliens, as with certain other species. G and L were adamant that all answers to our future and all the lessons of history had been written down for us to learn from and live by. Each major culture and each primitive culture had its standards, explained Thomas, but the move from a basic, primitive life to a life where selfish motives, however noble we tried to make them seem, prevailed, could and would lead to disaster and the final extinction of the human race. Our Christian Bible, supposedly, was the full account of ourselves, the written path of Homo sapiens. There may well be many truths passed down in the Bible, as in many other religious documents, as I have remarked on later. But I find it puzzling that the aliens failed at least to acknowledge some of the inconsistencies in various translations of the Bible over the centuries. Exactly how much of it is factual? Thomas's team had no axe to grind in this regard. By their own admission, they were neither atheists nor practicing Christians in the recognized manner, as Thomas puts it. However, G and L did indicate that we were a hold of too many religions, and would suffer for being so. They said the core of our numerous religions and creeds was a good and right way forward, but eventually humans would sacrifice their beliefs in a selfish manner, and our leaders would lazily accept this. I remember how G placed his hand upon his chest and said the incident at Roswell, New Mexico, and certain others, was a part of the path to doom for the human race. He said items stolen from them at that time would show us how to live well and prosper greatly in a way that no human need ever go hungry or thirsty, and all human problems could be solved using their technology before the century we called the 20th ended. But, he added, those in power will not wish it, rather would they have what they see as greater power. The aliens acknowledged the existence of Jesus, furthermore indicating that the so-called Second Coming was already in force, as also implied by Henry Doohan in Chapter 7. Officialdom frustrated. On several occasions, the duty officer complained to the team regarding official frustration at their inability to gain access to the inside of the craft. One of the team, Ian, said they'd done all they could, as would have been evident on the taped recordings of all their communications to, if not from, G and L. Several days later, the aliens responded, pointing out that the craft contained a self-destructive device which would operate if entry by any beings other than themselves was accomplished. They made it very clear, said Thomas, that they could open the craft in a matter of seconds in human time, and seal it closed just as rapidly. Only massive power could open it falsely. They told us the problem at Roswell was that having come in peace to exchange thoughts and certain technology, the mechanism of self-destruction concealed behind the small panel, with what we called a pentacle on it, was switched off. It seems G and L and their missing friend switched theirs to on again before the craft closed. G and L told us they had no intention at this time to open the craft. When I first met Thomas, he told me that this craft had come down of its own volition while the military combed the site where the other craft had crashed. He said that G and L were upset about the cruelty and treachery of their American captors in betraying their word. Given their wide knowledge of human fallibility, one can only wonder at the apparent naivete of G and L in this respect. Ancient history. The aliens expounded on their presence here on Earth thousands of years ago. Like the species with whom Carl Anderson liaised, Chapter 7, G and L described how their own people had been present during the times of the many kings, named pharaohs after 950 BC, who ruled ancient Egypt, and how the aliens were described as gods, but of course they were not. Thomas's team was advised not to mock what is written in the Bible, the Quran, the Talmud, or similar writings that foretell the future. For example, the Great Flood did occur and destroyed cities and countries, but mountains were left dry and habitable. They told us that a simple, basic change in the Earth's axis angle had caused the vast flooding, and that included the destruction of the lost land of what we now call Atlantis, which lay close to what is the island of Cuba. They produced maps of those places and times showing Antarctica before it was ice-bound, and land bridges before the final dividing of the land masses which were one. They told us these maps exist today copied onto the skins of antelopes in our 16th century, but only one has been shown to present humans, yet 30 of them exist even now in the land known as Turkey. They explained how their presence in Central America at a place known as Aztlan was to obtain gold and to enrich cultures and races that preceded the Mayas, and the forefathers of Aztecs were the people of Aztlan, and that the great floods drove them from their original, ancestral homeland. The aliens needed gold, and later silver, exclusively as part of their craft's propulsion system. The mothership, at around 2300 hours one pleasant warm night in 1957 at Weston's Oiland, Thomas became aware of a strange presentiment. There was little sound to begin with, he wrote, then a few shouts and the noise of vehicles, then the noise of a helicopter. But then our office phone rang. Code Orange. Code Orange. Have you any problems? I need an immediate appraisal of your situation. Alan came rushing in, saying, come outside quick. Lights, zooming about, amazing. Thomas reported the matter, adding that he was going outside to see what was happening. Watch the aliens, he was told. Do not leave them alone. Our two friends were fine, noted Thomas, seated up against their home couches and staring ahead. I asked if they were all right and, receiving affirmation, went to look outside, leaving colleagues, Keith and Cyril with them. Do not be concerned, one said. We are passing messages to our people. You can so inform your seniors later. The lights, a dozen also glowing orange and green spheres a bit larger than a tennis ball, Thomas guessed, could be seen zooming and hovering in a controlled manner. Forces personnel rushed around, concentrating on the number one hangar, its protective portcullis already up. One of the spheres came close enough to Thomas to touch. The only sound he detected was like that of a bumblebee. They watched two of the green spheres bob and bounce along the top of the electrified inner perimeter fence, then they returned to the hangar and sat with the aliens, letting Keith and Cyril watch the display. Farewell, all is well, communicated G. They will be away soon, their purpose here has been fulfilled. We ourselves feel much stronger now. We are grateful to the six of you, and you will not be forgotten. Our messengers will return to their craft, there is much they have to do. Is there a craft visible then? Asked Thomas. There is. It is very high at present and therefore only visible above the rain clouds, but soon it will move lower, not of necessity but to show the humans watching that real power and science is ours, yet we remain peaceful. You should both be able to observe the craft in an hour from now, so you can remain at your post without missing the sighting. You may tell your seniors that the craft will be observable between the two settlements, Weston's Oiland and Middlezoy, which lie each side of this military area. An hour later, Thomas, Keith, and Alan went outside. In front of us was an almost terrible shape, an intensely dark shape like a black thundercloud, Thomas recalls. This was totally mind-chilling. In front of us was a triangle. It was very, very big, dwarfing the V-bombers we, sometimes, had in camp. It was black, solid, and pulsing at about 50 feet from the ground, and it was creepily still, hovering and silent. No one spoke. The lights appeared along it and what must have been windows lit up. The shape of the craft became more defined. The lights, or windows, glowed yellow to orange, becoming richly colored but never reaching red. Eventually I felt there was a horizontal division and that I was seeing lights above windows. At first they played from right to left, disappearing around corners of the triangle and back again. Then, suddenly, all remained alight. There were no shapes of beings in any of the windows, we all agreed, There was no sound, no engines or machinery sounds as with all of our own aircraft and vehicles. And our camp had gone silent. No searchlights were shone onto the craft and no aircraft took off, not even a helicopter. As Thomas reports, this probably owed to the fact that most of the personnel in camp were asleep and, apart from those on duty, had simply not been told. The huge craft then descended to almost ground level. Then the lights began to flash again and the craft rose slowly. Violet lights showed beneath, emphasizing the craft's triangular shape, and without any sound to suggest rapid acceleration it left Somerset at a speed I could not even have guessed at. "That was frightening," said Keith. "I need a drink." So did the others. The following day, the aliens at first seemed unresponsive. Eventually they responded that this would be their last day in camp, that they were now recovered and grateful for the care they had received. G put his hand on his chest and delivered a lengthy and interesting speech to Thomas and Alan, which included ominous warnings of dire things to come. "We, or those who work with us, will decide Earth's future, and all life upon it." Later, L communicated some concluding remarks. "We owe the six of you so much. You will not be forgotten. We leave today, but be assured we will remain about and upon this planet. Say naught about these days to others, even to denying our presence if asked, unless we bid it differently to one or another in the future, for at least a quarter of a century, even half a century. Remember what we have told you. We cannot have all six of you here to say goodbye. Everything must appear as usual and as normal. So, tell the others and go about your lives." Shortly afterwards, the duty officer and two white coats appeared. Alan and Thomas returned to their office. As they and his colleagues were finishing lunch, the fire drill bell rang twice. Together with the others they ran back to the office. "Gone," shouted the duty officer. "Vanished. They damn well disappeared before our eyes. All three of us. Do you know anything about it?" "No, of course you don't. They were sitting there as usual. Saw them clasp hands, 32 and 33. Then my head hurt and I saw the other two holding their heads as I was. Then 32 and 33 faded. And their couch was empty. Gone. And that was it." There is much more to be learned about this truly extraordinary case in Thomas's book. Naturally, the questions arise: how much of the story is true? Although not a student of the subject, per se, he has read only a few related books. Apart from Roswell, for example, he was unaware of numerous other cases involving so-called crash retrievals of alien craft and bodies. Since his career in the rough features in the book, it was incumbent upon Thomas to submit his proposal for review by the Royal Air Force Historical Branch. And having stated in his introduction that readers can take the story as either fact or fiction, the RAF understandably relegated its status to the latter. They could hardly have done otherwise. Never will I forget the first time I heard the fundamental aspects of the story from Thomas in person. In spite of the many years that have gone by, he evidently retains a vivid memory of, and remains deeply moved by, these awesome events. Part 2 follows. Chapter 11. The Overlords. My study of the various types of alien encounters reported around the world includes a number of cases which initially I was tempted to reject on account of their absurdity. Yet subsequent reflection and comparison with other scarcely known cases reveal certain parallels that have caused me to change my mind. Sometimes, ludicrous, sinister, surreal, and even evil, elements feature in these cases. One such is that of Richard Hoagland, a Swede whose encounters covered a lengthy period. First investigated by Ernst Linder, the case is barely known outside Sweden. What follows is taken largely from several reports provided for me by Håkan Blomqvist, 1, to a leading researcher of contact cases, and from our many communications and discussions. He has written a book on the case in Swedish. 3. Born in Stockholm in 1913, Hoagland was a rock blaster by profession. Though by all accounts a very down-to-earth man, he nonetheless had an uncanny ability to read people's minds, a talent that might have some bearing on his experiences. The story begins on the afternoon of December 9, 1965, the day before he was due to undergo surgery to remove a small kidney stone. He felt a sudden urge to take a long walk with his dog on a frozen lake, Grindhultsjön, just outside Udiva, near Gothenburg, where he lived with his wife, Gunva.